There are some skeptics among us who say that the only people who talk about a ministry shortage are like Dr. Hufford at the end of the table over here and others like him who are recruiting students for programs like the one over in Memphis or recruiting them for our program here at Searcy or at other Christian colleges, universities, schools of preaching, what have you. Or they're raising money for those. And there really is no preacher shortage. Well, I've been doing research on this for a number of years. I think the most recent was fall semester of 2000. So it's a little out of date. But we did a study of all of the places where people are being prepared for ministry in churches of Christ. And at that time, there were approximately 4,000 in the pipeline. And that would be all the way from beginning freshmen here at Harding to people getting ready to wrap up a Doctor of Ministry degree over at Memphis. And others like them, 4,000 in the pipeline. Now, they're not all going to graduate the same year. We did a survey of those ministry students to ask about their ministry plans. Of the 4,000, 3,000 wanted church, full-time church-supported ministry positions. Less than half of them were willing to preach. Most of them wanted to replace Randy or me or one of us on the Bible faculty. I don't know if they tried to replace you over there at Memphis, but you know, teaching at a Christian college or university was a goal. Next highest goal was to be a youth minister. Less than half of them even considered preaching as an option. Now, what you have to do is compare that with the needs of the church. How many of you have copies of the latest directory published by 21st Century Christian called Churches of Christ in the United States? Okay, several of you. According to that, there are now 12,600 congregations. Used to be a little over 13,000, but there's been a 4% decline from 2003 to 2009. 76% of those congregations are similar enough to one another that no significant barriers to fellowship exist among them. The rest of them are limited in fellowship because of some doctrine or practice that sets them apart. But the big majority are in what that directory calls the mainstream congregation, 76%. And they have 87% of the members. So there are some groups that are anti-everything except anti-up. Have you ever run into some of those? They don't have too many of the members. And Dr. Hufford, I don't know if you've noticed this, but over here we don't get too many students from here being hired by those congregations that are outside the mainstream. So if you look just at the mainstream, here's what we need in order to fill available, you know, serve our present churches. We need approximately 6,000 self-supported ministers. Now, fellows that are going to be preaching on Sunday, but they have some kind of secular occupation. That's how many congregations we have that are too small to support even one full-time minister. Now, in the church growth literature, a big church is defined as one with 300 or more in attendance, two or more full-time church-supported ministers, and the dynamics of an organization. A small church is defined as a group with less than 200 in attendance, no more than one full-time church-supported minister, and more the dynamics of an extended family. And in between are churches that can't make up their mind, you know, which dynamic, you know, they prefer. That means that we need around 3,600 full-time church-supported preachers. Now, about 2,500 of them will be the only church-supported minister on the staff. They'll be ministry generalists. Pulpit, youth, education, janitor, whatever. You know, they're going to do it all. We need about 800 preachers who work with a youth minister. That in churches of Christ, the second person added to the staff is typically the youth minister. And according to Lyle Schaller, we're the only religious group in America that does it that way. In other religious groups, a minister of religious education, somebody working behind the scenes, organizing, kind of like our involvement ministers, is number two, and then youth comes in as number three on the staff. We have about 800 positions for youth ministers, and then 800 for preachers, you know, working with them. We have around 300 places big enough to support three or more ministers on the staff. So we need about 300 pulpit ministers working with a youth minister, and then involvement, evangelism, counseling, you know, whatever. Problem is that that's just to serve our existing churches. And the greatest need is to plant new churches. I brought along a handout that I have used with some of my classes that talks about population per congregation as one indication of where we need to plant churches. Here in Arkansas, we have one congregation for every 3,985 people in the local community. Tennessee, it's one congregation for every 4,347. I have all these figures on here, and I will pass among you and pass these out in a little bit. In New Jersey, one congregation for every 223,000. In places up and down the East Coast and in a variety of other states, we don't have very many congregations. The U.S. average is one congregation for every 24,000 in the local population. And the flip side of that page is population per adherent. And adherents would be your members plus the children. Hadn't been baptized yet, but they're in the Sunday school. In Tennessee, we have one member adherent for every 29 in the population. In Arkansas, it's one for every 34. But in Massachusetts, it's one for every 2,714. Anyhow, this is something that indicates where we need to be planting churches. The need there is unlimited. But the point that I'm trying to make is that in that survey we did, the big churches say we don't have a quantity shortage. Every time we have an opening, we're flooded with applicants. We have a quality shortage. Not enough people have the education, the experience, the talents that we want. In churches of fewer than 200 members, we have a quantity shortage, particularly in some of the U.S. mission field states. So we do have a preacher shortage, two different kinds. And we need to do more to recruit people, especially self-supported church planters, ministry generalists, and a few who will be the preachers for the bigger congregations. I think I've taken up about my time. Anyhow, your turn.
I'd say keep on going. I did find it interesting. Tennessee's about the bottom of your list. Well, it is on per adherence, but next to last. Arkansas beats us out on the smaller congregations spread out all over the place. But I'm in a congregation in Memphis, Tennessee, that has planted over 50 churches in the last 50 years, and two of them we planted in Rhode Island. So we've tried to do our part in working on this, but it is a concern. I'm just going to quickly go through some of my notes, and like to engage in a discussion with Flavel on this too, but I'll go ahead and do what I was supposed to do here. Randy asked to look in three perspectives in terms of shortage: reality, good, and bad. Left off the ugly. I guess he didn't want us to talk about ourselves or something, I don't know. But reality is this, as I see it. There's probably no shortage to find somebody who can get up and speak for 30 minutes on a Sunday morning just about anywhere. But there is a shortage. In fact, we are deprived of leaders who are trained to reach the lost, to feed the church, to equip leaders, and nurture healthy growth and development within the church. You can have warm bodies preaching and hired full-time and still have a shortage of good preachers and good leaders. So I think that's sort of a qualitative assessment to go along with this quantitative assessment. The good is this. I think there's a lot of zeal in church in planting new churches. I know from my perspective, we have 189 students at the grad school right now, and the majority of them are actually involved in full-time ministry. They live in 26 different states. When we have graduation every May, we don't have three students that are not full-time or in ministry somewhere. And usually those are two or three that are headed on to do a PhD program somewhere, and they're looking for a place to minister. So, but the other thing that's quite interesting in view of the fact that, you know, Harding and Abilene are two of the largest Christian colleges, they, if you look at their graduates, you'd say we have a major shortage in view of the fact we need 6,000 preachers somewhere, because we don't produce a fraction of that on a regular basis. In fact, I've said it this way: if our enrollment at the grad school in Memphis was dependent on what graduated from here, we wouldn't make it. Our students this year at Harding Grad come from 28 different universities. So the good news is I see a lot of interest in ministry. The number one thing is either church planting, missions, or youth ministry. So if the question is a shortage of preachers, you know, and what we would see is preachers, full-time preachers in a local congregation, I'd say there will continue to be a shortage from the lack of interest I see in doing that on the part of a younger generation coming up through churches. And I was trying to, this is just a perspective on it. I don't have the stats like Flavel does, but I would say out of every 20 new students we have at the grad school, I would have one that really wants to do pulpit ministry in a local church. And it's not because we don't want them and we don't try to recruit them. I think there are some reasons for this, and let me share a few of those, because I think maybe the reasons may contribute to our next hour's discussion on creative solutions. But I could go a lot of ways. I think it's very complex. But due to the fact I have four more minutes, I'm just going to zero in on one. So please understand that, you know, that there are other things we can go to, and I'm sure Randy can fill in all the rest. I think it has to do with both churches, just the nature of churches and leaders. I would say that probably the one reason we have a younger generation that does not want to go in ministry is the dysfunction in many churches between the churches and the leaders. Church leaders are not allowed to lead. There's no healthy process to cope with conflict in churches. And often a guy who's committed to preaching and ministry has a real heart and passion. He wants to serve. He's a tender-hearted, soft-hearted person. And to deal with conflicts in churches is going to take someone tough as nails. And so it's sort of like what you have to have to go with what the task demands just sometimes does not fit. A lot of churches are always on the verge of a split, which puts the minister in a real tough situation because he can often be treated as an employee himself, not as a brother. His family's not treated, I think, with care. And so often we judge the health of a church by whether we just have peace, not by whether we have growth or a sense of mission. And most of younger men coming into ministry are very visionary. They want to see the church grow. They want to see something happen. They ask the question, where is this church going? And what is it going to do? And often those questions fall on deaf ears, or the answer they get just is extremely discouraging. So they want to go plant churches, but in order to plant churches, unless they're bivocational, those very same churches that frustrate them need to support them to go plant those churches. So now we've got this kind of vicious, dysfunctional cycle in a lot of ways. The other side of that is just leaders themselves. And what I've said is just the church as a whole can often be dysfunctional. And a lot of these less than 200-member churches are. They've not had good leadership, which is one of the things that's kept them below 200 in a lot of cases. On the leadership side, now we do have some guys coming through who are converted in a campus ministry and have had no church home. They feel disadvantaged because they haven't had a long-term family church experience. But sometimes that's a good thing, because we've got guys who've come through churches and they really have a heart and passion for ministry, but when they see the way the preacher's been treated at the church where they've gone, or if they're in a church that does have a youth ministry, then their only knowledge of ministry is youth ministry, not ministry among adults. And so that there's a huge gap in how we do youth ministry and how we do adult ministry, if you will. And I think they fall between that crack. And then in leaders, then, as they view leadership in the local church, these are things that discourage them from going into ministry. They see leaders who are led by fear and secrecy. I guess the thing that frustrates a lot of them, when they see things that are wrong, good people say nothing. You never have good people challenging the challengers and saying, whoa, you can't do that. That we don't all think that way, or we don't all feel that way. Or we may agree, but that's not the right attitude to address it in. And as a result of that, it really does discourage anybody from wanting to step into that mess. And yet we have so many churches, and I really think if I were to look at this just pragmatically, if you want a job, go into preaching. There's a lot of, and you're good. There's a lot of churches that are needing someone who can provide good leadership and preach, but it is going to take, I think, a lot of skills and equipment and training to do that. Another thing I think in leadership is a lot of them just quit trying to grow just to keep the satisfied. Actually, it's the never satisfied satisfied. And I think that discourages many. And a lot of leaders never do a very honest self-assessment. And when they do, it's a bit unfair, I think, in a lot of ways. They're very unrealistic about what they expect of the preacher, and very, I think, not very self-reflective on the weaknesses of their own leadership, and not open and honest about that. I think a younger generation will accept a lot of weaknesses if they recognize, if they're recognized. If leaders will just say, we're struggling with this and we need to find help in that, that would encourage a lot of younger guys to say, okay, you know, they're open to that, we can do that, we want to help the church grow. And they are coming along who really have a passion for the church, but leaders themselves discourage them. So my time's up, but at least that's the reality of the good and the bad from a more qualitative perspective.
There were a handful of things that you mentioned that I could just zero in on, and you kind of captured my focus on the handful of items you put out that I appreciate a lot. But one of the things I would start with is saying that I'm going to reflect a few reflections from Charles Seibert, and we had hoped that he would be with us, and he's not able to. I remember in graduate school, I still have bitterness over this. In graduate school, I did a knockout paper on Romans, and I got a B on that paper, and I thought, how in the world did I make a B on that paper? And so I went to see the professor, and he told me that I did not take into consideration Kummel's article on Romans 7. Well, Kummel's article was in German, and I don't know German. And so I communicated that, and he said, well, it's such an important article that you can't write a paper and not show that you're aware of it. I said, I'm aware of it. He says, you need to show it. So I got a B for not acknowledging Kummel's article. I feel sort of that way about Charles Seibert's stuff. Whenever it comes to a question like the minister shortage, I think that you ought to automatically get a B, C, perhaps even a D on anything that you say in response to these questions if you don't take into consideration what Charles Seibert says, because he spent so much time focused in this area and has done so much good work. I just think it's crazy to not have his voice as a part of the conversation. So I don't want to make a D, and he's my old professor and hero, so I don't want him to hear this and give me a D. So I want to just tell you a couple things from Charles. And one of the things he says is that over the last 20 years, as he's been seeking to help churches find ministers and ministers find churches, that he has a smaller pool of candidates now than what he has seen in 20 years. This is a guy who daily is involved in helping ministers and churches connect with each other. And so out of that experience over the last 20 years, it's the lowest number that he's seen. He has fewer names on his lists of ministers. There are not as many families who are encouraging their children to pursue ministry as a chosen vocation. He speaks about the substantial student loan debt that often goes with this. There's a higher demand for competency for ministers than there has been in the past. We've become a more educated group in the Churches of Christ as well as in our country. And so there's more demand for a higher skill level, greater competency, yet the expense of that compared to what you end up making is often difficult. A good number of ministers leave frustrated, discouraged, and defeated by congregational ministry. I think a lot of the kinds of things Dr. Hufford has mentioned drive some of that. And so, you know, would join in his voice along those lines. Also, many believe that they can make a more meaningful difference in serving in some other capacity. That if you want to be bound to economic dependencies, be a preacher. But if you really want to make a meaningful difference, you're going to have some other angle of entry into this. And then, of course, there are, sadly, the moral failures that occur. And what drives those would be interesting to look at as well. But those would be some things that Charles would put on the table. For myself, I would say that I believe there's an incredible opportunity that is before us on this question. But we've got to start out by recognizing something that I think this room actually illustrates for us. It's very easy for us to be talking to empty chairs on this question. And I think that we may have more in the next session, possibly. But the reality is there's just not a lot of interest in this question. Whether or not this question is a question we ought to be asking. Putting that to the side, whether we should or shouldn't be asking the question. There's just not a lot of concern and involvement and investment in this question. And so we are dangerously close, I think, to just talking to ourselves on this. And so that is one thing I would say, that clearly there is a shortage, and I would say that there is a serious shortage that is reflecting a lot of other root causes. I agree 100% with what Dr. Hufford has said, in the sense that this is a complex reality. It will not be explained adequately, and it will not be fixed, if we can use that language, with a simple solution. It has a multiple dimension thing to it. It has multiple strands and threads, and so any solution will be solutions in the plural. They will be complex, and they will address a range of issues that are connected. And it is seeing those connections that is so important. I would say that there is a decline in competence. There's an oversupply of incompetence and ministers driven by the wrong motives. Often people will go into ministry because they can't, won't, or don't do anything else. And we inherit a lot of that we are supposed to now train and give some skill set or information to, that all of a sudden is going to turn them into people of character, of noble motives, who are willing to sacrificially serve beyond their own egos and needs for validation. And that's just a very difficult task. A second thing is, I would say that the best among us are going elsewhere, meaning by that they do find other channels for service. I have found that across the country, I've just collected names and conversations with people that I look at them and I say, why in the world are you not serving as a shepherd or elder in the church you attend? And whenever I get the answers from a number of people who are shepherds, they may not serve in that capacity, but these are at heart shepherds. When I listen to their rationale, they often will tell me that they can be shepherds more effectively if they don't bind themselves to a lot of what they experience in that role. That's one small piece. But I think that something comparable is happening with ministers. Even the leadership literature, Maxwell, talks about leadership is influence, plain and simple. It's a matter of influence. And there are people who want to make a difference. They do not feel guilty because they want to change the world. They want to see change in the church. And they come at this hoping to have an influence, not just because of some ill motive where they're imposing themselves on the rest of the world, but sometimes very noble motives, but they want to make a difference. And as they are a steward of their influence, and they think about how to get the most impact from the least investment, but willing to invest all, they often find that another capacity is the best way to do that. I would say that there's a minister shortage that you see in the voice of some people who predict the decline of the pulpit preacher. I think there's a decline of preaching. You'll notice in more and more services you have a higher number of singing and songs and reduced time for preaching. And so we have less and less capacity all of the time for a word of God to us. And so that begins having something to say. And our assumption about worship even is in these little sound bites and little nuggets that you can get and these fragmented pieces that are brought together in an overarching theme, yet at the same time just not a lot of tolerance or patience for sitting through understanding substance from Scripture and having a theological understanding that we are challenged with as well as comforted by. And so the capacity of the church for theological engagement becomes more and more shallow. And I think it also puts a demand on the pulpit and ministers to respond and adapt to that. And we happily do so, unfortunately. And we do that to our own long-term demise. I would say the enrollment numbers at Harding Graduate School, at Harding University, at Abilene Christian tell that there is a minister shortage. Since I've come to Harding, which has been in the last 10 years, the numbers have gone down. It's discouraging to talk about those numbers. When I came 10 years ago, we had what I perceived to be an inflated number of people going into youth ministry. Even that number has gone down. And so clearly the enrollment numbers are telling us that there is a decline in this area. I personally think that the focus on and the massive move towards so many people going into youth ministry is a part of the systemic reality that we struggle with and what drives other kinds of ministry shortages. But we'll talk about that more later. And then the last thing I would offer as a fact is evidence for the reality of a real shortage is your consultants. Flavel says this, Dr. Hufford says this, Charles Seibert says this, I say this. I think others that work in this area would tell you that in the experience of helping people connect to have fruitful, effective ministerial partnerships and connecting people who are trained to be full-time ministers is more and more difficult all the time. The last thing I would say to kind of close my little 10 minutes out would be to zero in on something that Dr. Hufford mentioned, and that is he talked about, and I think there were a number of nuances in what he said that would be fruitful paths of consideration. But just zeroing in on one of them, he said the nature of churches. You know, in the nature of a church, we talk about healing, forgiveness, redemption. We attract people that have baggage by virtue of the message that we ought to be proclaiming. And this is a place where you should be able to absorb more dysfunction than in some other places and to truly find deep healing. But that also does have a challenging reality that brings with it. And so I'll tell you this, that I have found, I'm a part of a professional group of consultants who have nothing to do with church. They talk about the spirituality of leadership, but it's very shallow. It doesn't have theological substance to it at all. But these are highly gifted individuals who have worked with some of the most prestigious institutions in the country in terms of universities. They have worked with companies like the Dana Corporation, which has 40 to 50,000 employees across several countries. Those kinds of entities they work with all the time. And when I've been with those groups and had the opportunity to give them ministerial dilemmas that typical preachers in the Church of Christ will face, I have repeatedly have them tell me, well, when that's the situation, we find some other company to work with. And the truth is, there are leadership, ministerial dilemmas in terms of leadership that are much more complex and challenging than what you're going to find in the rest of the world. And is my time up? I've got 5 minutes. Well, the last thing I'll throw in here is that in the churches of Christ, I think that whenever you're talking about the preacher, you've got an intersection that they get caught in. In the churches of Christ, our theology is driven by reactionary theology. We know what grace is not because of what the Baptists say it is. We know what the Holy Spirit does not do because of what the Charismatics say the Holy Spirit is doing. We know what the preacher is not because of what the Baptists say the preacher is. And so our theology is highly reactionary, and we define the preacher's role by saying he is not a pastor. But in the churches of Christ, our theology is also very patternistic. We like to look at the pattern. We look at what the early church did and say that is the template. And so we look for examples. We look for patterns, and we feel secure if we feel like the first century church did this. And so whenever it comes to patterns, we look at things like 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus. And where do you go in Scripture to understand the role of the preacher? Well, we don't like the idea of Timothy being a person who rebukes an elder in the presence of the others so the others will fear. We don't like the idea of somebody other than the elders in 1 Timothy managing the money and making financial decisions about the distribution of the money. We don't like the idea of a good deal of what we see when we come at this from a pattern perspective. And so we talk about Paul's relationship to Timothy, and we've got a lot of ways to deal with that. But I think that whenever it comes to elders, for example, we have a little bit more on that in terms of the biblical insight. But what we do is we take this reactionary expectation for preachers. You're not a pastor. But we have a pattern that we say you need to fit the biblical model of a preacher, which we're not sure what that is. And we impose that on them, so we expect you just to preach the word and then shut up everywhere else. But at the same time, we want you to do ministerial leadership and pastoral care, but don't think you're a pastor. And we struggle with partnership between the various dimensions of leadership in the church. And we don't know what to do with the preachers. And the preachers become the most vulnerable economically, and they navigate in the churches of Christ, I'm confident, the most complex, difficult role expectations of any leadership role I've seen anywhere in any organization. And those that do it well are few. Those would be my reflections. So, you had mentioned as you began that you would like to engage Flavel, so I feel safer if you engage him instead of me. But why don't you kind of spark this and take this where you would like to with either of us, but just kind of pulling us into this threefold conversation here.
I assume that this, we're still trying to assess the problem. We'll talk about solutions in the next hour. Flavio, you've been at this. I mean, your perspective of the Church of Christ is a lot longer than ours, given your age. How do the challenges of preachers' shortage compare to 40 years ago? Can you give a historical perspective on this?
Okay. Let me go even further. I started preaching 50 years ago. 60.
Well, I was guessing. I wanted to be gracious.
And I'm 50 years old.
And back then, churches were so desperate that the route that you would take to getting ready for ministry anywhere, you start with a little country church, go to one a little bit bigger, and you know, we didn't have youth ministers. That hadn't been invented yet. The church was producing its preachers. I should have been paying churches for listening to me in those early years. They didn't pay me much, but at least it took care of the gasoline to get over where I was preaching. We don't have that model now. The model that we have now is more, they've seen youth ministers, and they can go into that until they're mature enough, experienced enough, maybe to make the transition. I think that, you know, I would say that the shortage is a lot worse now than it was then. Numerically, the demand was greater, but I started when I was a sophomore in high school. And there was a little country church in Ravia, Oklahoma, where I got my first 18 months of pulpit experience. By the time I dropped out at Abilene Christian, matter of fact, by the time I enrolled, I'd already had more pulpit experience than most of the guys do coming out of the graduate program now. It was a different ball game.
Randy, what difference do you see boomer elders making in your assessment of kind of church dynamics as more boomers become elders? Is that changing things?
You know, I see a lot of exit.
Yeah.
And a lot of willingness to exit and less willingness to stay with a group that limits them. And it seems to me that a lot of times that's what it's about. is I am limited, and they have very little patience with the rest of the group, mm-hmm. and have an ideal of what they're going to pursue, and the ideal in their mind is more important than the people who are actually launching them.
Mm-hmm. Does that have a carryover into these younger guys that watch now? Because some of those, their sons could be good preachers because of, you know, the family dynamic and encourage them and that kind of thing. But I think a lot of them don't see the preacher as very significant.
That's right.
I mean, it's that whole, that they feel like they can serve in the kingdom in other ways better than preaching, like some of these guys feel like they can serve in the church better than being an elder. I mean, I wish it weren't that way, and I'm not trying to be a cynic early in the morning, but it, you know, that's what we hear. And I assume I'm not the only one that sees that kind of attitude.
I think, too, that's a lot of what I was referring to earlier, in the sense that the people who, you know, the boomers, they want to make some difference, but yet they're very consumed and self-consumed, so they end up imposing their own vision on everybody else. And as they do that, sort of a negative and positive, in the best of that, they are caregivers of their influence. They don't want to live meaningless lives. And so they are seeking to get the most mileage out of their influence. And so they say, this is not the role to do it. Mm-hmm. And at the worst of it, it ends up being about them. And it's very self-serving.
I think what Dr. Hufford brought up earlier about churches being dysfunctional, that's one of our big problems, because people don't want to be preachers, they don't want to be elders in a broken system. You know, for the last couple of years, I've been working on a survey of why people are leaving Churches of Christ. And I'm working on a chapter right now that's leaders who left. Preachers, youth ministers, one deacon, several elders. And they have a lot of the complaints that we have been expressing. You know, we've talked about the education of pulpit ministers. Who's educating the next generation of elders? I've done over 100 congregational assessments over the last 30 or 40 years. And in every one, I ask, what are you doing to train the next generation of leaders? I have yet to find a church that's doing anything. They just kind of assume, you know, we can handle it as long as we're alive. And we're not going to risk bringing in anybody who might upset our apple cart. And sometimes very paranoid, not trusting of the members, not allowing the members to select additional elders. If additional elders have to be selected, the present elders pick them. And the church, the eldership becomes more and more inbred. I've done Myers-Briggs studies of churches and elders, and have empirical proof that when the elders select the elders tend to select people that are very much like themselves. I just finished a study where at one time they had, 6 elders, 5 of them were in the sensing, feeling column, and 4 of them were identical. Extrovert, sensor, feeler, judger. They kind of build the church or the eldership around themselves, trying to communicate with a diverse membership, and communication breaks down.
We are a few minutes past the time to stop, so we're going to go ahead and stop. That's okay. And then we'll start back. I believe it's 9:45. Is that correct for the mm-hmm. next session? And so we'll hopefully get into some fun, creative possibilities.